this world.
I'm curious about how you think people perceive you.
As a danger, as a risk, as a potential risk to them, to their safety, to their way of living.
Do you understand why society has so much anger towards you?
Yes, I do understand, but I don't think it's actually towards me. I think it's towards ISIS, but when they think of ISIS, they think of me because I've been put on the media so much, you know?
But they only did that because you chose to go to ISIS.
But what was there to obsess over? We went to ISIS, that was it. It was over. They just wanted to continue the story because it was a story. It was the big story.
But you do accept that you did join a terrorist group?
Yes, I did.
Newspaper headlines.
Three friends stride confidently through Gatwick Airport, heading to war-torn Syria.
Hundreds and hundreds of Western Muslims have been attracted to this death cult.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left London to join the Islamic State group. For the first time, she's given her account of what happened over the last 8 years.
Shamima has become a lightning rod and a polarizing figure.
I don't trust her. I think she's dangerous. I think she's radicalized.
Was she trafficked? Was she groomed?
We've been filming since the day she left and investigating her claims for more than a year to understand the truth about the Shamima Begum story.
When you throw your lot in with the devil, don't expect the niceties of what Western democracies and Western justice stand for.
They were children, they were manipulated.
We have probably let this child down at some point.
Could Shamima Begum been prevented from reaching ISIS?
There would have been a possibility, yes.
They can't expect us to come back to the UK and be welcomed with open arms.
I think she shouldn't come back, she's made her choice.
It's really complex, she's really complex.
She was radicalised here. It's our mess and we should clear it up.
The runaway ISIS bride has had her British citizenship revoked.
If you did know what I knew, you would have made exactly the same decision. Of that, I have no doubt.
The Shamima Begum story. Bethnal Green, London, February 17th, 2015. A red London double-decker passes a row of shops at night.
I woke up early in the morning, maybe 5-6 o'clock, because like our flight left at like 12 o'clock, so we just wanted to be there early. Our bags were already somewhere else, like hidden somewhere else. I had to make an excuse as to why I was going, so I was just like, I have extra classes that I need to go to, and my mum believed me. I just stood there with her, you know, it was just being quiet and stuff. And then I got on the bus and I said bye, and she was just being really quiet. You know, it's not normal for her to be so quiet. She was just staring at me and not saying anything. And I just said bye to her and I got on the bus and I left. And I feel really guilty, obviously, not giving her a better goodbye, knowing that I would probably never see her again.
Grainy CCTV images of three teenage girls.
At the airport, there's a photo of you walking through the Gatwick scanner. What's going through your head?
I felt like I was, like, not inside my body. It felt like a dream. That was one of the scariest moments of my life, just handing the passport over to the man and him just, like, not even looking at it, just gliding it past and handing it back to me and telling me to go.
Do you think you're ever coming back to Britain?
Really, at that time, I just was not thinking. My mind was, like, completely blank. But I guess, yes, I thought, this is the last time I'm going to see the UK. Yeah.
Did that worry you?
I mean, in a way, I felt kind of relieved.
Shamima Begum's interviews are monitored by Kurdish authorities.
Can you take me back to 15-year-old Shamima and life before ISIS?
Whenever I describe, like, London to people here, I just always talk about my friends because I feel like my friends were a significant part of my life. Khadiza and Amira I met when I was 11, and they were the fun part, you know, they were the happy memories.
Amira was quite outspoken. She was in different clubs, societies. She was even on, like, posters and stuff around the school. Khadija, really tall, and she was quite beautiful, if I'm honest, so she used to stand out in that sense. Shamima was a ghost. She's quiet. I mean, I could hear a pin drop louder than her voice, you know? She seemed like she was in her own bubble.
We were all different, but weirdly, we just like fit together like pieces of a puzzle, you know? And then when we were 14, 15, you know, we became religious.
Was the Shamima before that not particularly religious, though?
Not at all. Like, not at all.
What was the change?
Shamina became religious after her mum died. She was my closest friend. She was someone that you can confide in and she'll listen to you. I mean, the way she was talking about it, it was very persuasive, but even if it wasn't persuasive, you know, I just wanted to go along with what my friend wanted, you know, so I could be accepted. And I didn't want to give them a reason to, like, you know, exclude me from the group.
A train passes through Bethnal Green, London.
I'm curious to know, like, about your sense of identity at that time.
I didn't feel British or Bengali. I didn't feel Bengali because I didn't want to be Bengali. And I didn't feel British because I feel like I wasn't able to be British even though I wanted to be, if that makes sense. You want to be accepted by society, but I didn't feel like I was accepted by society either because of racism and other things. Obviously, I just wanted to be a bit more free.
Being Bengali myself and being a brown girl from the same area, I could understand where she's coming from in the sense that she felt like culturally she was different, she was Muslim on top of that, she came from a disadvantaged background. So in society, you are sort of seen as a black sheep.
Former chief communications officer for East London Mosque.
You know, it doesn't take a genius to just stand in an estate in Tower Hamlets and look around you, and you would have kind of grown up in kind of semi-poverty-like situation.
Graffiti on a shuttered shop.
It's ironic because it is set against the backdrop of the City of London and the district of Canary Wharf. It does become a very hostile, challenging environment to grow up in.
It's really hard wanting to integrate into society, but your family holding you back because their idea of being British is being loose and, like, immoral.
Cultural expectations on a young woman would have been, yes, you're going to school now, but ultimately, you know, when you come of a certain age, you have to get married. And then, basically, that's pretty much end of the line for you.
What was the Shamima like for your parents?
Just, like, depressed and quiet and obedient and just not content with my life. And in a way, resentful to my family for, like I felt oppressed. But, you know, that's an exaggeration at the time. Because I was just a teenager, I felt oppressed, but, you know.
June 2014.
The Sunni extremist group ISIS has announced that it's establishing an Islamic State known as a caliphate, made up of territory that it seized in Iraq and in Syria. It's also proclaimed its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, as the leader of all Muslims. Iraqi government forces are still battling.
When did you first become aware of ISIS?
When Shamina wanted to leave. She sent me the news clip of the caliphate being announced. She explained what it was and how we have an obligation to go and, like, you won't be able to practice your religion properly in the UK and, you know, like, the UK is racist and it's Islamophobic, you know, why would you stay in a place that doesn't even want you? You know, things like that. I mean, when she first said it, it just sounded impossible. I'm like, we're only 15, we can't go. And then she said, no, other teenagers have already gone, so we can do it too.
And what were your first impressions when she's saying this?
This girl is crazy. This girl, she's crazy.
Really? Like
she's lost her mind. She's not there anymore. And then she was like, okay, fine, I'll just leave by myself then. And then she did it. And then she started contacting us from within ISIS, and describing like the situation and how good, great it was. And it just, it made it more real and it made it more possible. We just immediately started planning. I mean, Charmaine already did it, so she just told us. And there were obviously other people online telling us and like advising us on what to do and what not to do.
What shifts someone from sympathizer to traveler? It was that the travelers knew someone who'd gone. So the barrier to entry becomes lower if you know someone who's traveled. I think it's very reasonable to suggest that without Sharmina, Shamima does not go. She's talking to her friend who's saying, this is fantastic, here's how you do it, I can arrange it for you. What are you waiting for?
What did you think you were going to?
Like an Islamic utopia, I don't know.
A glossy ISIS propaganda video, a man paying for food at a market, then another man using a candy floss machine.
I had only seen one small clip of an ISIS propaganda video, which was the Eid video. Families in the parks together, the men saying, you know, come here, come with your families, it's safe, you know, you can live a good Islamic life here, you can build a family, you can be happy, you can go to paradise.
For young people seeking a sort of solution to, you know, problems that they're facing, that can suddenly become quite seductive. ISIS propaganda is well known for the ultra-violence, but only about 8 or 9% of ISIS's output was that ultra-violence. Of course, that's the bit that captures the headlines, and therefore it's what we all know and associate with the movement. But that's not the only part of the picture that she will have been offered, right?
As the media would like to tell you, things are pretty chaotic here, but what I've come to see here is there's actually a really good medical service being provided here, lots of hospitals.
This is where your sense of identity and belonging have their natural home. And this is where all these issues are resolved. And ISIS propaganda was quite good at saying, this is a United Nations of Islam. Whether you're Arab or not Arab, black or white, you know, none of these things matter.
I wish you were here. August 2014.
This is James Wright Foley, an American citizen of your country. As a government, you have been at the forefront.
There was a lot of very critical things of ISIS in the news at the time, and you must have had some awareness of that. How do you ignore that, or how do you perceive that this is still the right thing to do with all the atrocities that they're committing?
To be honest, I did not know about these atrocities because I, as a 15-year-old, I did not watch the news. I got my news on social media, and like the people who I spoke to on social media were saying, no, it's not true, it's an exaggeration. They're just trying to make ISIS look bad because they hate Islam.
President Obama has tonight described the beheading of the US journalist James Foley by an extremist from Islamic State as an act of violence that shocks the conscience of the entire world.
The aid worker David Haynes, held for 18 months in Syria before being murdered, has been called a British hero by the Prime Minister.
In the last hour, a video has been posted on the internet which appears to show the British hostage Alan Henning being beheaded by an Islamic State.
Do you get why people will find it hard to believe that you just didn't watch ISIS propaganda in London?
Yes, I understand why, because they weren't 15 and they weren't me. They don't know my situation, you know. Maybe more people have access to, I mean, especially journalists, they don't understand why I wouldn't know, because they're journalists, they search the deepest, darkest parts of the internet for all these videos and they know every single detail about ISIS, so why would I not know?
I mean, these videos were on Twitter and YouTube, so it didn't...
But they were constantly being taken down and, like, deleted, so it was very hard to watch these videos. And the people who I was talking to who were in ISIS didn't send these videos either.
Shamima Begum has claimed that she didn't see the sort of videos of people being executed that were so widely publicised. Do you think that's true?
Don't believe it. And no reasonable person would believe it. However much you're a teenager watching at home with the Kardashians, doing loads of stuff on social media, being physically welded to your mobile phone, nobody, particularly three intelligent students from East London, could have been absolutely oblivious to the horrors that were being waged by Daesh out in Syria and Iraq at that time. Just doesn't wash.
The one time I did hear about an execution was from a kid in school. He came and said that ISIS had just burned a Jordanian pilot.
ISIS propaganda video, a man in orange overalls standing in a cage.
So I went online and I asked Sharmina, hey, is this true? Did they burn a pilot? And she said, no, it's a lie. What happened was he was flying over ISIS territory and ISIS shot him down. The plane crashed and caught on fire. And the video is of them dragging his body out of the flames. And she just said the media just twisted it to make it look like ISIS had executed him.
Yeah. And you believed her?
Yeah, because she was there and I wanted to be a part of the Islamic State, and I just, it's like when you're in love and you don't want to see the person's faults, so you just like push them to the back of your head, or you just completely deny that they are there, you know? Like I was in love with the idea of ISIS, so I just always made excuses for them.
Issued an urgent appeal for help in finding three schoolgirls from London who are believed to be trying to join jihadists fighting in Syria. The three teenagers flew to Turkey on Tuesday without telling their families.
Police say three missing schoolgirls believed to be heading for Syria will be in grave danger if they reach the country. The teenagers, who are pupils at Bethnal Green Academy in East London, were last seen boarding a flight to Turkey on Tuesday.
When the girls leave, at the beginning, they're seen as victims. Our unease and our fear as a society that Islamic State can reach out from Syria into the minds of British schoolgirls at their homes and lure them away, two of them aged 15, to a war zone. And that was a frightening on a number of levels.
East London Mosque, now filmed in 2015.
So these are the images of the girls that the police have released. This is Salman from calling from the East London Mosque. Is this to do with the news that broke today? It is. So is that your sister? One of the individuals. Okay. Is it possible for you to come and visit me at the mosque?
For the first time, when I spoke to Shamima's sister on the phone, she was distraught. She was crying. She was asking for prayers and so on. And that really broke me.
Just so that you're comfortable, we've already had conversations with the police, inshallah, and we're going to try and get them to do as much as they can to bring them back here. And if you need anything from us, right? Huh? No, we're going to make dua. We're going to make dua. Don't cry. Don't cry. Please, don't cry. We'll do everything that we can. Yeah. Okay. Don't cry. All right. I'll let you go now.
I think there was almost a feeling of loss before we knew that we had lost. And it was really hard to stomach.
Salman, the former chief communications officer for East London Mosque. Shamima Begum and her two friends have flown to Turkey. They've been told by ISIS to go to Istanbul bus station where someone will meet them. Now, grainy CCTV of three figures walking into a bus station. Carrying luggage, they're wearing heavy winter coats, backpacks, and hoods over their heads.
While the world was looking for us, we were just in the coach station. Yeah.
On CCTV, they walk through the station.
We like changed our clothes, we like dressed a bit more Islamically. We contacted the smuggler who's gonna help smuggle us across the border. And we just waited for him. Then other families started to come into the coach station who also wanted to come to ISIS, and we just sat there with them. He finally came in the middle of the night. We had to buy food obviously, so the smuggler took us outside to exchange money and to buy food, and then he would like escort us back to the coach station, but he said we're not allowed to go outside by ourselves, so we didn't.
How long were you sat at this coach station for?
Oh my God, for like an entire day, just sitting and waiting and sitting and waiting.
On CCTV, they walk out of the station. Now in reconstruction, they climb aboard a bus.
finally get onto the coach after like one day.
Gliding above a white bus as it slowly drives along a road and out of the coach station.
We were in the coach for maybe half a day until we finally got to Gaziantep.
1 hour from the Syrian border, February 20th, 2015. Shamima Begum and her friends are being transferred between cars by an ISIS people smuggler. He secretly recorded footage of Shamima Begum's journey to ISIS. The smuggler's name is Mohammed Rashid. We have obtained intelligence files that reveal he was a key figure in a highly organized ISIS smuggling network. In reconstruction,
we all get separated and then just got into a bunch of cars, kept switching cars, maybe 7 times. We were just doing everything he was telling us to do because he knew everything and we didn't know anything. So
Mohammed Rashid may have smuggled more than 140 people into ISIS-controlled Syria. 2015, to Shamima Begum's sister.
What's the message that you're trying to get to her if she does see this?
We love her and she's our baby. If anybody is telling her that they're going to love her more than us, they're wrong. Nobody in this world can love her more than we do. My little sister still sleeps in the same bed as my mum. And it's just... I'm sorry, give me a second. We just want her to come home. If you watch this, baby, please come home. Mum needs you more than anything in the world. You're our baby. We just want you home. We want you safe. We crossed the border. It was just a big field of nothing. And there were like men wearing all black with their faces covered with guns on their arms. And it was just a bit surreal, you know, seeing it in person.
What are you thinking?
I mean, at that time, it was kind of exciting.
Really?
It was kind of exciting, yeah. It was different. It was...
You weren't thinking these men are dangerous? These are
potential
terrorists?
No, I thought they're here to protect me. They have these guns to protect me. And to protect women like me, and to protect the Muslims. So I did not think in my wildest dreams that they would hurt me.
A low-lying son.
They take us into a room, they search us, they search our bags, they take our passports, they take our phones, and then they just tell us, okay, wait here until the bus comes for you guys to go to Raqqa. The woman in charge of the bus stop, you know, she liked us, I guess, and she gave us a phone and we just looked up. It was the first time I really sat down and watched all the ISIS videos and I was just in complete shock. I was just in shock. I don't know what to say.
What's going through your head when you're watching those?
I was just very disturbed, but I just couldn't say anything. And I would look at my friends' faces to see if they're disturbed too, but their faces were too neutral for me to react, you know, how I would want to react.
I mean, in that moment, did you want to change your mind?
I just thought, there's no turning back. I've already done it. I might as well see it through.
Did you ever think about changing your mind at any point along the journey?
No, not along the journey. Not from the Syrian border, yeah.
Anybody who saw those gruesome videos and wanted to remain in any way associated with that organisation engenders very little sympathy for most people. This is joining up with people who are against everything we stand for and want to kill us. That's as bad as it gets.
At night, in Raqqa, Syria, the de facto ISIS capital, streetlights do little to illuminate the gloomy roads where a young boy cycles on a bike. In reconstruction, a woman in a niqab is sitting in a car as it travels along quiet streets.
Three schoolgirls who disappeared from East London last week
have made their way into Syria. It's feared that they're already under the control of the extremist group Islamic State. Hamza Parvez, British, joined ISIS 2014. He sits down for an interview which is monitored by Kurdish authorities.
I remember I read an article about her and her other two friends that came. I read on Daily Mail.
While you were in Raqqa?
They were all over the news. Everyone knew about their arrival in Raqqa. And everyone was talking about it.
They just sort of obviously think that it's going to be really fun. It's going to be some kind of adventure. But it's really not running away to join the circus. It's much more serious than that.
Am El Baraa, Syrian, joined ISIS 2014. The arrival of young girls of that age from far away was an endorsement. That our state was a legitimate one. Even my sister told me that they mentioned this in the Friday sermon. They even mentioned this story on the radio, saying they were an example to follow.
They could not believe in a million years that three teenagers would leave their good, comfortable lives in the UK and make it to Syria without being caught by the government. Like, they could not believe it.
Now, when they got on that aeroplane, I don't know whether they were terrorists or not, but the likelihood is that by now, or very soon, they're going to be terrorists.
Late February 2015, Shamima Begum and her friends are taken to a house for unmarried women, Madafa. They meet their friend, Sharmina, the first girl to leave London, who inspired them to join ISIS.
They brought us to the Madafa at night time, and we reunited with Sharmina. I was just so happy to see her. She was at the top of the staircase and we were at the bottom of the staircase and we just like screamed our girly screams and just like ran up to each other and hugged each other and cried, and we were just so happy to see each other and everyone was happy to see us. You know, it was a nice feeling, you know. Felt like sisterhood. All the negative feelings I had for her about lying to me kind of just like washed away. I was just so happy to see her safe and just there, and we were just like all reunited and like together again. It was a happy event.
Bethnal Green, London. Pedestrians walking past market stalls.
With the three schoolgirls beyond the reach of their families and the police, this has now become a blame game on how they could have made it to first Turkey and then Syria.
Tassim Akunji, lawyer for the girls' families, 2015 to 2016.
I wanted to try and find out if there's any scraps of any information that would help us work out if the girls were in contact with anybody in Syria. In Shamima's house, we managed to discover a letter from the Metropolitan Police. It was addressed to the parents of these girls, requesting their permission to question the girls officially around the disappearance of Shamima. But it was clearly handed to the girls themselves to give to their families. And none of the families had seen it.
So just so I'm getting this right, before the three girls from Bethnal Green leave, there's an active investigation into one of their friends who's already gone to join ISIS.
That's correct, yes.
And nobody outside of the school, in terms of families or anything like that, is aware of this?
No one else is aware of this, though. It was absolutely ludicrous.
A former chief superintendent.
What the families were uncovering was that the police knew a lot more about these girls, liaison with people who were grooming them, who were radicalising them, and hadn't shared that information with the families.
Could I call the committee to order? This is a session...
The families are furious about a letter from the police, which might have alerted them the girls were about to flee the country, a letter which they say they never saw.
This afternoon, their families appeared before MPs, complaining that when a classmate ran off to Syria in December, nobody told them.
Miss Begum, you are the older sister of Shamima. Would it have been better if the police had handed the letter directly to yourselves?
If we'd received the letter, we would have contacted the police, found out where has this first girl gone, if they gave us that information, and I would have spoken to my sister.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry we're running a tiny bit late, but most grateful. Family want an apology because they think things could have been handled much better. What would you like to say about that, Commissioner?
Well, first of all, we're sorry if the family feel like that, and clearly it's a terrible situation they find themselves in. I'm also sorry that, you know, the letter that we intended to get to them didn't get through, because clearly that failed. It was intended for them, and it failed, and for that, of course, we're sorry. I don't think we would go as far as saying, therefore, that caused the girls to go.
Can you just tell me how you felt seeing that letter?
It made me and my friends feel like we need to move faster, you know, before we get in trouble.
These three girls were not the first girls at that school to be radicalised and, in fact, go to Syria. So one girl was already there. Another girl was actually taken off a plane in an attempt to go there.
Presumably, though, if one girl goes, if the police are running an investigation, it's probably not pertinent for them to share information, right? Because it might interfere with their investigation.
Well, it depends on what your priorities are. You know, is your priorities about gathering intelligence about these girls, or is your priorities about safeguarding? But I know that they were more interested in gathering intelligence.
We have discovered that intelligence agencies had knowledge of Shamima Begum's smuggler before the girls left the UK. Huda Mukbil, senior Canadian intelligence officer, 2001 to 2017.
I was shocked to see how young the three girls were. And so following those developments is something that I did do.
And you were in the intelligence community at that time?
I was, yes.
I just want to talk to you a little bit about Mohammed Rashid. This is a man that moved Shamima Begum to Syria.
Mohammed Rashid.
We've got a dossier of hundreds of pages of information that was gathered by law enforcement and intelligence. It shows that Mohammed Rashid was gathering information on everyone he helped.
I forget to give you the passport.
Copies of their ID documents, flight tickets, passports, and that Rashid was even entering into Syria and documenting the location of ISIS fighters. It also shows a confession by him that he provided Shamima's ID documents to Canadian intelligence.
Do you know if Mohammed Rashid was a Canadian asset?
I do not.
But if you did know, you wouldn't be able to tell me, would you?
No, I would not be able to tell you.
A very senior serving intelligence officer at an agency has confirmed to us that Mohammed Rashid was indeed providing information to the Canadians. How do you feel about that, hearing that?
If indeed he was working on behalf of an intelligence agency, the activities that he was conducting are essential to intelligence collection. And so, you know, that I don't have issue with. But there is a line that I feel was crossed in this operation that has, you know, risked the lives of minors. And that's a line that should really not be crossed. And so this would be an operation that has gone wrong.
Do you think there's a possibility that Shamima Begum could have been prevented from reaching ISIS?
Yes, there is. There would have been a possibility and a way to prevent that.
In Raqqa, a flock of birds fly over rooftops through a cloudless sky. Some market stalls in a row at the side of a road. Shamima Begum has been living in a woman's guest house, Madafa, in Raqqa, for 3 weeks.
Once we started to get settled into the Madafa and I saw the situation and I saw the way women were talking about, you know, Islam and like the things that ISIS are doing and how they think it's so great, it started to make me realize that this is really real and it's kind of scary. There was maybe 100 women and there were like probably more than 100 children. It was so packed and it wasn't clean. It was so horrible. I was so desperate to get out. I couldn't do it.
A ceiling fan.
How do you get out of a Madafa?
The only way is to get married. There's no other way. You have to get married. It almost felt like prostitution, really, in a way. Like I had to give my body away for my freedom.
A still image of a smiling Khadiza.
Khadiza married a Somali-American man. He worked in the hospital. And Amira married an Australian.
I deliver this message to you, the people of Britain. We will defeat you, bi'ithnillahi ta'ala. Takbir! Takbir! Da'watul Islam!
First you say, you know, I want to get married, and then they take down your information, and they ask you what are your preferences for what type of man you want to marry, like age and nationality and language. And, I mean, if you want to be more detailed, you could even, like, say what you want them to look like. And they would just, like, get the list of the men, because the men have also given their information, and just kind of, like, pair you up.
In a Syrian prison facility, Yego Redek, a Dutchman who joined ISIS in 2014, sits down in a darkened room for an interview. The slim man sports a beard and mustache and has cropped hair. He appears to be in his early 30s. He takes a sip of water.
Well, my friend came to me. Said there's a girl, she's interested in getting married. You interested? I said, yeah, I guess I'm interested, yeah. So we sat down. We had a meeting, me and Shamima.
I was really shy, so he just, like, introduced himself, and then I introduced myself, and then he was like, you want to ask me questions? And I had, like, a list of questions I wanted to ask him.
She wanted to be allowed to visit her friends, live close to the market. Some things like this. I said, yeah, no problem.
What did you want from him, like, as a husband?
Just a partner in life, to be my friend, to be my companion, to love me. I wanted to be loved because I felt like I was not loved. So I just wanted someone, you know, to be there for me always and to protect me and love me.
Just wanted a partner so I can get out and find some rest with, spend my days in Syria, somebody take a bit of care of me, you know. I asked her if you knew how to cook. She said, yes, I know how to cook. I said, okay.
Why was that important to you?
Because I need to eat. And I like nice food.
It was kind of exciting for me because I'd never been in a relationship, so, and I was, my entire life I'm just surrounded by women, so it was kind of a new concept being with a man for me. And it was a little scary as well because I was like, this is the man I'm gonna have to spend my life with for however long he's alive or however long I'm alive. So it was just, it was scary, yeah.
We don't have such a thing as dating, going out, having a meal together. You get to know each other like a little bit. If you click, then you decide to take the step. We want to get married and that's it, we got married.
Secretly recorded footage from Raqqa showing families enjoying themselves in a park.
Then he took me to the park. That was really weird, like, for the first time, like, seeing the park, you know, the famous park that the Eid video was done in.
A propaganda video of the park showing two young boys riding on a horse and smiling.
We sat down and we just started talking more. I got more comfortable with him, obviously, when it was just more one-on-one time and it was more chill and stuff. I want to say good things about him because there obviously were good things about him. He was very protective of me. He did take care of me, you know. He was funny. He was really funny. I'm not going to lie. He used to make me laugh.
A Ferris wheel and empty bumper car ride at night.
There was this small, like, theme park. I took her to once. We had a nice time. Ferris wheel. It was a very small Ferris wheel. Old. Took a ride in it.
I was just happy to be out of the mud and just breathing fresh air and being outside.
The Ferris wheel at night.
What are you learning about Shamima?
Oh, she was very young when she came. She didn't have a lot of life experience. There's not a lot of person to get to know. Most of her life experience and what makes her to who she is today is the life experience that she got in the Islamic State. But when I got to know her, she was basically an empty paper.
And what did you learn about your husband? Because he'd been in ISIS a lot longer than you, hadn't he?
Yeah. I don't want to say.
Because as I understand it, he was an ISIS fighter. Is that correct?
I guess, yeah. Before I was married to him, he was, yeah.
How did you feel knowing that he was a fighter?
I mean, I thought he was doing the right thing. So I just thought, you know, he was fighting for his religion and for the state.
She had got a little bit of understanding about how the marriage life works. So that helped her out a lot.
What were those sort of values that she'd come to understand?
Respecting of the husband. Trying to please the husband. Obedience, of course.
Obedience to whom?
To the husband.
To the husband?
Yes.
So you expected Shamima to be obedient to you?
Yes.
What does obedience look like to a husband?
When I ask her to do something, then she does it. It's not very hard.
What if she doesn't want to do it?
If she has a valid excuse, she doesn't have to do it.
It's an interesting way of phrasing it, in a valid excuse, because that doesn't seem like there's much choice in that dynamic between the two of you.
No, there is not, actually, no.
There's no choice?
No.
So what you want, she has to do?
Basically, yeah.
It doesn't seem, from where I'm standing, that that's a particularly healthy place for somebody to be. That doesn't seem like two people are equal in that relationship.
We're not. But she chose for that, and she's happy with it. She's very happy with it, and I'm happy with it, so...
When you say, so she's not equal to you in that relationship?
In terms of, I am the one in charge, basically, yeah.
So you're around 21, and yeah. Shamima would have been how old?
She was about 15 at that time.
So you decided to marry a child?
She was underage, yeah. I wouldn't consider her a child, no. But she was underage, yeah. You might not agree with it, but it doesn't mean it's not right.
A flag fluttering in the wind, then an aerial view of traffic passing along a street in Raqqa. A quiet alleyway with a shuttered-up shop.
First, I had to get a house. Wasn't very successful. So my friend, he was nice enough to give me a room in his house. He was a married man from Egypt. And that was our new home.
Did you feel positive about the relationship?
I mean, at first, yes. He was obviously very nice to me at the beginning, so it was okay.
And then what happened?
And then he just comes home one day and he's like, I have to go to prison. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, it's okay, I think it would just be for like a couple of days.
Why did he go to prison?
Because they thought he was a spy.
How long were you together before he went to prison?
10 days. And he asked the man and the woman in the house if they could take care of me, if I could like stay. And they said, of course, she can stay as long as she needs.
She refers to an Egyptian with whom she stayed in northern Syria. Now, who is that Egyptian? She was very opaque with me about it. It was one of the subjects she didn't want to go into and kind of skipped around, which drew my attention to it. If I was a cop, I'd be wanting to know, who is this Egyptian? What was his influence on her? That's important.
We have repeatedly asked Shamima Begum about the Egyptian man. Second audio interview.
You said that you and your husband stayed with an Egyptian family.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of their names or anything like that?
No, I don't.
Any of their kunyas?
No.
And what were their names?
Their kunyas were Kamra and Abu Kamra. That's it.
And they were Egyptian?
Yeah.
And you don't know their real names?
No.
But you don't remember his actual name? His non-kunya?
I think it was like Saeed or something.
Saeed?
Yeah, I heard his like wife say it a few times and then him answer, so that must be his name.
Saeed?
Yeah.
What was his personality like?
He was really nice. He was really nice to me. He was like a father figure in a way.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know what he did in ISIS?
No.
You never heard anything, any sort of Arabic or descriptive term of what his job was?
She shakes her head. We travel to Raqqa to investigate Shamima Begum's story. We found a man who says he provided electricity to Abu Komra, the Egyptian. Abu Komra was a foreigner who came to ISIS. He was responsible for providing weapons. He was a vicious person and spoke in an aggressive manner. He was a bad person, bad in the full sense of the word. If she was living with him, she would have known all the details about his life. It's impossible she didn't know. Impossible. To Huda Mokbel.
What's the significance of this man potentially being an armourer for ISIS?
Well, it would mean that he played a significant role on behalf of ISIS, providing weapons.
Why might Shamima change her story or potentially conceal information from me?
There's fear, there's trauma. This association in itself could mean that people would see her as a threat simply by that association. There are also consequences in terms of, what she's able to freely say, knowing that, any information can also incriminate her.
So we've been told that he was arming ISIS members. Had you ever heard about that?
No.
How do you feel about the idea that you were living with somebody that was providing weapons to ISIS members?
I don't know. Really. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't believe that, firstly. And secondly, I don't know how to respond to that answer.
Gliding over a large billboard with Arabic writing, then a group of women in burqas walking along a busy road, one of them carrying a child in her arms.
What was it like being in Raqqa?
It almost felt like a movie, like I was in a movie. Seeing the roundabout with all the, like, restaurants, it was a lot to take in. It was kind of like what I imagined, kind of not like what I imagined. Seeing how everything was functioning and stuff, like it was normal life.
Did it feel very different to Bethnal Green?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, a lot.
How?
I mean, firstly, there were guns. There were a lot of guns. And, I don't know, secondly, it just felt more restrictive walking around. Like, when you go outside, you can't, like, lift up the first layer of your veil that just shows your eyes. You can't do that, even though it's hard to, like, walk in the street. You know, if you do, even for 1 second, like, a guy from across the street will, like, yell at you.
It's sort of well known that in Raqqa people would hold public executions. Did you ever see any of that?
No.
I mean, people might find it hard to believe that you didn't.
Well, I mean, I didn't go outside a lot because my husband did not let me go out a lot. And while he was in prison, the man I was staying with also did not let me go out a lot, so, yeah.
How long was he in prison for?
7 months.
What were you doing for 7 months?
Sitting in that room, just doing nothing.
To Huda Mokbel.
Shamima Begum's told me that she rarely left the home in Raqqa. Do you think that's plausible?
When you look at, this type of ideology, the woman's place is really in the home. You know, they wanted to grow the caliphate, and you can't do that without women. So predominantly their role was to marry fighters and breed children who they can train and radicalize and be of the same ideology.
Did you question your decision yet, or did you still think you'd made the right choice?
I mean, I always, in the back of my mind, was, like, questioning my decision, but I knew there was nothing I could do about it, so I just had to keep, like, persevering and going on, you know, trying to live this new life that I decided to be a part of.
A city at night with various food stalls flanking roads. Anthony Lloyd is a special correspondent for The Times.
The Shamima's narrative, which is essentially she was just a housewife. She stayed at home most of the time. She got married fast. Then there is the narrative that, in fact, she was an active member of the terror group. Shamima Begum does have some very big questions to answer.
Shamima Begum lived with ISIS for almost 4 years. Little is known about what she did during that time.
There have been a number of allegations made against you in the media over the years, and can we go through them? Mm-hmm. One such allegation is, did you ever help prepare suicide vests?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Did you ever try to recruit people or encourage them to join ISIS?
No.
Never at all?
Never.
Did you communicate with friends back in London when you were with ISIS?
I don't want to answer that question.
Did you receive any form of training? Were you given any of that?
No. Not at all.
Khalid, former ISIS religious police, Hizba. We were in a training camp. There were only girls, of course, so she didn't have her niqab on. So that's when I saw her face. All the girls who join ISIS for the first time are enlisted in this camp. Sometimes there would be religious studies, and sometimes they introduced weapons training. They wanted to brainwash them with religion to recruit them.
Was Shamima part of Hizba?
I did not ask her if she was part of Hizba or not.
Were you ever a member of Hizba, ISIS's religious police?
No.
So there's a woman in Hizba who says she saw you receiving some training?
No.
No?
When I first came, when I first crossed the border?
At any point during your time in ISIS?
I mean, I'd like to specifically know when so I can say what I was doing instead.
Let me rephrase it. Any time during your life in ISIS, were you given any form of either religious training or weapons training?
No.
Nothing at all?
Nope.
Do you feel that it is fair to prosecute you for being a member of ISIS?
No.
You don't feel it's fair to prosecute you for being a member of ISIS?
No.
Why not?
Because being a member of ISIS is defined as, you know, doing their bidding, working for them, and I just did none of that. If anything, I was a burden on ISIS.
You did go and join ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
You were a member of that group. That group was committing genocide and committing mm-hmm. crimes. You are part of a group that's doing those things, and as a result of that, you share some responsibility for that group's actions.
I understand what you're trying to say, but really, I'm not going to take responsibility for other people's actions. It would have happened regardless of whether I was there or not.
All of them did something. All of them bear responsibility, no matter how small their role was. We lost so many people. We lost a beautiful country. We lost a life we were happy with. Enormous destruction. We lost institutions. We lost schools. We lost homes. We lost everything because of a lie called the Islamic State. This is not our religion. And it doesn't represent us in any shape or form. This country was given a death sentence.
I think one of the biggest struggles you're going to have is because you don't seem to associate your presence within ISIS supporting the group. There is an accountability that needs to be had for your membership of that group. Do you agree with that?
If I go to court and a judge says that I have to go to prison for a certain amount of time for this, then yes, I will go.
But you, of course you would, because the judge has made the decision. That's different towards what you feel. And what I'm just trying to understand is, if you truly understand that you being part of this group in some way helped them and was an act of support for that group.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
I understand, yeah, what you're trying to say, and I would take responsibility for it.
So you would?
Yeah.
And you understand that that group committed acts like genocide?
Yeah, I do understand that.
So when you reflect upon that, how do you feel about your decision to be a member of that group?
Ashamed of myself for being so stupid, for falling for something like this. Just a lot of regret.
Gliding above the Black Stadium, an ISIS torture prison where Yego Redick was allegedly held. From above, the oval-shaped track looks derelict and sits next to hundreds of bombed-out buildings.
What happens on the day you're released? Can you take me through that day?
Well, it was a shock. I thought I was a dead man walking. All of a sudden, I get put into a van and I get dropped off somewhere in the middle of Raqqa. As of course, I was happy. It's euphoric.
There was a knock at the door, and I just, like, opened the door, and my husband came in, and we just stared at each other, and then we didn't say anything, we just hugged each other.
Gave my wife a very, very, very strong hug. She was very happy to see me as well. It was a very, very nice moment, yeah.
Yeah.
Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I was surprised and happy, though, that he was out and that he was not a spy.
Yego and Shamima's apartment building, a small, unassuming block with a red towel hanging over the window.
We got an apartment of our own and got to spend some time with her, got to know her.
He was a very different person than when I first married him. He was just like very quiet and reserved and just didn't show his emotions as much. You know, it was hard for him to stay in ISIS after everything that they'd done to him. He didn't want to continue being there. He didn't want to fight for them.
Do you remember the moment that you became disillusioned?
Yeah. After I got out of prison. It's like, what the heck is this? Where did I come to?
He had no friends because he found out that all his friends were talking about him while he was in prison, so he just cut them all off. And I felt like I didn't want to see my friends, you know, because they would just talk about how great ISIS is, and I just didn't want to hear any of it. So I was just at home with my husband. And that was hard, you know, you start to lose your mind when you're just only stuck with each other.
How was his behaviour towards you in that period?
Just taking out his anger and frustration on me because of the situation he was in.
Was that abusive?
Yeah.
In the apartment, a gust of wind causes the towel over the window to flutter back and forth.
Did you ever try to leave ISIS?
No.
And why?
Because it was just too hard.
What would have happened if you'd been caught?
Probably put in prison and tortured because they would assume that I'm a spy for wanting to leave. If they could do it to my husband, then they could maybe do it to me too, you know.
Residential tower blocks in Bethnal Green, London. The girls have been in Raqqa for 8 months. Shamima Begum's friend Khadiza has lost her husband in an airstrike. She contacts her family in London. She wants to escape ISIS.
Hi, Khadu. You okay?
Hi.
How are you?
The internet cafe next to Khadiza's house.
So how am I going to get out?
So how am I going to get out? You know the borders are closed right now.
Okay, but I don't know if I want to do this. Because I don't feel... I don't have a good feeling. Like, I feel scared.
What, you feel scared?
Yeah.
Why do you feel scared?
You know, if something goes wrong, like, that's it.
I know what you mean. I understand what you mean, and it is, you know, from where you are, I can understand.
I learned that Khadija wanted to come back from her auntie. She was crying, saying that she was on her own, and she wanted to come home. We'd been working with another family to get their daughter back from Syria, unconnected to this, and we'd already formulated a plan, so it was fortuitous. A lot of people trying to get out of ISIS by this stage, and ISIS were desperate to stop people getting out, and they were executing them.
There was a point where Khadija seemed to want to leave ISIS. Did you know she wanted to leave?
I did not know. This was the time where their husbands had died and my husband had just come out of prison. So I was with my husband mostly, and my friends were living together in their own house. So all of this was going on without my knowledge.
Hadou, I understand that you're feeling scared, yeah? But I don't trust your friends, you know, by the way.
I mean, she's a young woman, and she was in the impossible situation of trying to assess whether staying where she was more lethal or less lethal than trying to escape, which, if caught, is lethal. But, yeah, these are the choices that war presents you.
I kind of just look forward for the next call. That's what keeps me going.
Khadija decides it's too dangerous to escape. 6 months later, she's living in an apartment building where ISIS militants are operating. Still images of a building reduced to rubble.
The night I heard the bomb, I didn't know at that time like how much it would affect me.
Khadija's former apartment building has been completely destroyed.
And the next morning, Amira and Shamina, they came to tell me that Khadija had been killed. And then we were told we had to go to the hospital and just to identify her body. So we went and we identified her body. That was one of the lowest points of my life, I guess, seeing her body like that, you know. With her, it's just like a constant reminder, you know, that She could be alive today, but she's not. And in a way, it may be my fault. Because if I had said, you know, I don't want to go to ISIS, guys, don't come either. Or if I told the police the truth, maybe she would still be alive. You know, maybe we would have never gone to Syria. Maybe they would have never spoken to me again because they would see me as a snitch, but they'd still be alive. And that would be enough for me.
So you feel guilty?
Yeah.
But they made their own decisions, didn't they?
They did, but I feel like I could have stopped it. It's just how I feel.
Is it hard to carry that around?
It is. And if I ever do go back to the UK, having to face their families is going to be really hard.
Moving along a war-ravaged street with mounds of rubble and crumbling buildings, a motorcycle crosses a junction, passing the shelves of former homes. The US-led coalition is fighting ISIS. Airstrikes are pounding Raqqa. Explosions cause plumes of smoke to rise over rooftops.
When I was pregnant with my daughter, maybe 7 months, the bombing started to get really bad. And my husband looked at the situation and he said, Raqqa is going to fall and I don't want to be here when that happens.
The situation looked very unstable. I didn't want to be there for the fight.
But he also did not want me to be there in my condition because I was pregnant. I felt like I would not have been able to survive ISIS without him. Even though there were hard times, I told myself that it's worth it because if I did not have him, I would lose my fucking mind.
So I told her we're going to have to move soon. She says, okay, we'll move. So we pack our bags and we went to Deir ez-Zor.
Driving along a road next to an arid-looking plain.
I was at the end of my pregnancy. You know, I gave birth. I was just by myself, you know, taking care of my daughter with my husband. Didn't know much.
There was nothing more beautiful to me than my daughter So it wasn't easy, but still, you know, there was the family element and I did get to enjoy, you know.
It was really scary because I didn't know anything about being a mom. I barely knew anything about being an adult, let alone a mom. But obviously, after I gave birth to my daughter, the bombings scared me a lot more. They made me realize that I'm not just responsible for myself, I'm responsible for another human being that completely depends on me. And I took that very seriously. And it was a really big burden on me. And then right after I gave birth, I got pregnant again. So I gave birth to my son like 11 months later.
The Ferris wheel, not turning, sitting in front of derelict buildings. Raqqa has fallen. The US-led coalition is taking ISIS territory. Now, drifting over the rooftops of destroyed buildings covered in debris. Diego Reddick.
Did you worry about bringing kids into that environment?
I didn't think it was going to end like that. I didn't think it was going to be that bad.
There wasn't anything in the shops to buy anymore, like milk and diapers for kids and food, and like everything became more expensive.
What happened to the children?
When you make wheat, when you make flour, there's a waste product. Like the shells that they give to, like, I think, cows and stuff. That's what he was making, like, a sort of soup of, I guess. And there was some green stuff growing outside. That's what we was eating for maybe months on end. So first of all, my son, he passed away because if she didn't have breast milk and he couldn't eat. Afterwards, my daughter, she got really, really skinny, and at one point she couldn't stand up by herself anymore. And at one point I came home and I heard that she had stopped breathing and they brought her to the hospital.
She was my world. She was my reason for living through everything, through ISIS and through my husband's abuse. You know, she just kept me going. You know, I was living for her. You know, I wasn't living for anyone else but her. So when she died, it was like my entire world just collapsed around me, you know. But the only reason I didn't kill myself was obviously because I was pregnant with my second son. But if I had not been pregnant, I would have taken my life.
A vast desert, then an explosion and a black plume of smoke among a collection of rural buildings.
Pounded by artillery, the last vestiges of the first modern-day caliphate are crumbling. The supposed utopia becoming a mass of death and rubble.
I knew, and everyone else knew, that there was nowhere else to run. This was the last place, you know. There's no plan B. I was really depressed. I didn't want to get up anymore. I didn't want to get up and run from the bombs and the fighting. I just wanted to, like, just lie down and die. But my husband kept pushing me to, like, get up and go.
We walked out together with a group of Syrians and Iraqis.
From sunrise to sunset, we were walking. And I was heavily pregnant at that time, so that was hard as well. And I was severely malnourished as well. We didn't know where we were walking. We were just following the person at the front until we finally, like, met these soldiers.
We spent a night in the desert. After this, we got separated. I got taken to prison. My wife got taken to the camps, and that's the last I've heard of her.
Would you want to reunite with Shamima?
Yeah, that's, of course. She's my wife. How can I live without her?
Would you want to be with him?
No.
Why not?
You know, I just stayed married to him in ISIS because to survive, but out in the real world, I wouldn't need him. And I wouldn't tolerate his crap because I don't need him.
But you did love him for a while, right?
I don't want to answer that question.
A line of people walking through the sand, some holding children, others pulling wheeled suitcases. Anthony Lloyd.
Thousands of women and children were coming out of Baghouz, and they were being bussed up to Al-Hol camp. Lots of wire, lots of tents, pretty ragged tents. Kids, you know, pretty thin kids running around through the kind of mud and dust. All these women, all still dressed in black, in full niqab. These thin, quite undernourished women who have been through it in a camp at the edge of a desert. I just remember sitting in the administration block and chasing this conversation on for a long time, kind of in circles with this administrator from the camp. Like, I'd really like to speak to some of the British women who might have turned up here from Baghouz. He then reappears with two women who are fully covered. And so I say, you know, obviously I want to speak to you. And she says something back to me in a, you know, London accent. And I'm, wait, hang on, wait, you're from London? And she's like, yeah, I'm a sister from London. I'm a Bethnal Green girl.
She said, I'm a Bethnal Green girl.
I'm a Bethnal Green girl. I'm a sister from London. I'm a Bethnal Green girl.
Almost 4 years to the day that Shamima Begum left London, she has made it out of ISIS territory alive. Her husband is in prison. Her two children have died. She's 9 months pregnant with her third child. Anthony Lloyd.
So the first thought that went through my head was, right, OK, I need to take control of this environment now. This is important. This isn't a conversation with someone who's just come out of Baghouz. This is Shamima Begum. This is Bethnal, one of the missing Bethnal Green girls. And it was quite easy between us speaking. It was immediately like, OK, you are straight out of Islamic State, you're straight out of Baghouz, but you're also a London girl, and we could kind of have this slightly bipolar conversation.
I was there for only 3 weeks, so after that I got married.
Then you lived together in Raqqa or somewhere else?
No.
What was that like? Was that an experience which fulfilled your aspirations of what it was?
Yeah, it actually really did. It was like a normal life. The life that they show on the propaganda videos, you know, it's a normal life. But every now and then there are bombs and stuff.
Did you ever see executions?
No, but I saw a beheaded head in the bin.
In the bins?
Yeah, screwed
in. What was that like when you first saw that? These are the heads of captives?
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't faze me at all.
Being unfazed doesn't interest me so much. What interests me far more is the logic around how that guy had his head cut off. I said, who was he, a captive or what? And she said, yeah, he was a captive. He was seized on the battlefield. So I'm like, well, didn't it bother you that he ended up beheaded? And she said, no, just think what he would have done to a Muslim woman. There's this immediate radicalised logic. She is speaking like that because, as I would exactly expect her to speak, she's been with Islamic State for 4 years, and that's how you speak. That's how you think.
I have to think about my baby as well. After my two kids died, Now I'm really overprotective of the baby. I'm scared that this baby's going to get sick in this camp. That's why I really want to get back to Britain.
When is your baby due?
Officially 9 months. I should be giving birth any day now. Especially with this situation, I will probably give birth soon.
Why do you think she walked out of Baghouz?
She wanted to save her baby's life. More than her own. Some women wouldn't have wanted to come back to save the life of their unborn child. They would have said, you know, it's the will of God. I live in the land of Caliphate. If Allah wants the life of my child, then he'll take it. You don't automatically assume that a woman's going to say, I need to go home because I want the NHS to save the life of my unborn child. Just before I left, I said, can I take your photo? And so she sat down and I just took 5 frames.
Still images of Shamima, then the front page of the Times with the headline, Bring Me Home.
Straight to the Times, Bring Me Home.
In one way, she's back from the dead.
She said she had no regrets about going, but now, 9 months pregnant, she wants to return home.
I don't know that Britain wants people like that back in this country. Is she still filled with hatred for this country?
If we do have a no-deal Brexit, do you want to come back to the UK?
I mean, this is a woman who marries an ISIS terrorist and is, for all intents and purposes, herself an ISIS terrorist, isn't she?
She's 19 years old, she's an adult. We don't want her back.
You wouldn't have her back then?
No, definitely not.
She should be done for treason.
Yes.
And she's a risk for this country.
She should stay where she is.
I'm telling you, she's a traitor.
Everybody had an opinion about Shamima Begum. Every pundit was out there writing something on TV, saying this, that and the other. You know, some people in the media were just saying, let her die in the desert. I mean, this is mainstream media. This wasn't just on social media platforms.
After that interview, you know, I gave birth. And while I was in the delivery room, like, recovering from giving birth, you know, there was a knock on the door and there were journalists who wanted to speak to me. You know, it's just a whole other thing.
Underneath her black abaya dress, she cradles her two-day-old son. Shamima Begum stuck with the extremists until the very last moment. But now she wants forgiveness.
So here's your opportunity then to apologise to some of the people who were murdered by the group that you joined. Some of the British men, some of the women, some of the kids from Manchester who were killed in the Manchester arena. You must have heard about that attack. What did you think about that?
I was shocked, but...
What?
But I just couldn't... I didn't know about the kids, actually, but... Yeah. I do feel that it's wrong that, like, innocent people did get killed. It's a two-way thing, really. Because women and children are being killed back in the Islamic State right now. And it's kind of retaliation. Like, their justification was that it was retaliation, so I thought, okay, that is a fair justification.
Do you regret saying this?
Of course I regret saying it, you know.
What would you say to survivors of that attack?
I'm so sorry that you went through this. And I in no way support it. And if I could, I would spend the rest of my life trying to persuade people not to do things like this, who may fall into things like this.
An earlier interview.
How are you feeling?
I just gave birth, so I'm really tired. Yeah.
And can you tell me a bit about the child?
It's a boy.
It's a boy.
Yeah. I felt very used by the journalists. I felt like they did not care about my mental health and where my mind was at that time.
Could you describe for us what it has been like to live with and under Islamic State?
You know, at first it was nice. It was like how they, you know, showed it in the...
Media crews move around a gated compound.
I felt like an obligation to say the things I did. Because of the women in the camps, you know, they who still had these radical ideologies, who still loved ISIS, you know, and who considered anyone who spoke bad about ISIS as non-Muslims and so someone they could kill if they wanted to.
Shamima, hello. Take a seat.
Until our conversation this morning, Shamima Begum had assumed she was coming back to Britain.
Have you heard anything new about your case?
No. I only get information about my case every time a journalist comes to me.
What was the last information that you'd heard?
That not everyone wants me to come back and it might take a bit of time for me to come back.
They got this in the post. Okay.
But I'd come here with a copy of the letter sent to her parents yesterday, stripping her of British citizenship.
Please find enclosed papers that relate to a decision taken by the Home Secretary to deprive your daughter Shamima Begum of her British citizenship. In light of the circumstances of your daughter, the notice of the Home Secretary's decision has been served on file today, 19th February, and the order removing her citizenship has subsequently been made. Okay then.
What do you think?
I don't know what to say. So I don't know why my case is any different to other people. Or is it just because I was on the news 4 years ago? I feel like it's a bit unjust on me and my son. But yeah.
But you've done this to your son. I mean, this is a consequence of your actions.
I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say.
She seemed dazed, shocked, but in control. Except she's not.
What did you feel when you found that out?
just hopeless and depressed, and for the British government to just completely renounce any responsibility over me, I felt like, you know, like I had nowhere else to go, and that my son also had nowhere else to go. Like I just had no hope of living anymore, you know, and I, you know, feared for my son and his life.
I absolutely understand the Home Secretary's move, which has been upheld in our legal system, that she should be stripped of British citizenship. There has to be a consequence when you go and join an organisation which is effectively dedicated to destroying Britain and all it stands for and all its citizens, for whom all of us are fair game.
Al-Raj Camp, northeast Syria, March the 7th, 2019. A sea of blue and white tents in the desert.
After all the media attention, I was brought to this camp, and then just one morning I woke up and he was really pale and his lips were blue and he was struggling to breathe. I went to the clinic and I said, please, my son is like close to death. I don't know what's wrong with him. Please take him to the hospital outside. And after like a lot of begging and arguing, you know, they took me outside. So we went to the big hospital, you know, and they just put an IV in him and put me in a room with him alone, away from everyone else, and just left me there, you know, with the soldier standing outside the door, you know, while he was still struggling to breathe. He passed away maybe in the middle of the night, just, you know, I just was completely numb and emotionless. I was like, I think my son is dead. So she called the doctor and he tried to resuscitate him and it didn't work. So they just left me in the room and I had to stay there all night with his body, because I couldn't be taken to the camp in the middle of the night. I had to wait until morning to take him to get buried.
The baby son of the teenager, Shamima Begum, who has been stripped of her UK citizenship for joining the Islamic State group, has died in Syria.
Begum's newborn baby has been buried in Syria after dying of pneumonia. The teenager who left London to join the Islamic
Shamima
State
Begum,
group.
The teenager who left the UK to join so-called Islamic State has died in a detention camp in Syria. The 19-year-old gave birth last month. The Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, stripped her of her British citizenship.
Oh my God. Now this. Yeah, young woman, three kids dead. Like 6 month period, citizenship removed, you know, smashed to pieces, national hate figure. That wasn't a great moment.
Can you tell me how many times you were pregnant?
Five times.
You were pregnant five times?
Yeah.
But you had three kids?
Yeah.
How do you feel now when you think back to your children?
I felt like I could have done more to save them, you know, like gotten them out of this life. But in a way, I felt guilty for even bringing them into this world, this horrible world, you know.
In the camp, young children walk between tents along a gravel track strewn with rubbish. Two boys play with one another. Thousands of men, women and children who were with ISIS have been left in makeshift detention facilities run by Kurdish forces. The facilities are considered insecure. Shamima Begum has been in detention for almost 4 years. Now she's wearing a baseball cap and dark shades.
I'm curious because we first started talking, believe it or not, almost a year ago now. What's changed since then?
Nothing. I don't know. My situation legally is still the same. I still don't have citizenship. At least with prison sentences, you know that there will be an end, but here, you don't know if there's going to be an end.
What do you think you'll be doing in 7 years' time from now?
Still be in this camp.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think you'll be home?
Nope.
Not at all?
Nope.
Why not?
Because ISIS was the worst thing of the 21st century, and I was a part of it, and now I have to face the consequences of my actions, and this camp is the consequences of my actions.
Where they supported my decision unanimously, and I think it's pretty clear-cut.
Do you think it's kind of once a terrorist, always a terrorist? Or, I mean, is she basically forever going to be stateless? Do you think that that's what she deserves?
I am clear that the decision is both morally right, absolutely right, but also is legally correct, and it is the right one to protect the British people.
Shamima Begum has become the avenue by which people are discussing ISIS detainees. And there's a lot of confusion. What do we do next? All of these ISIS people are in detention now. What happens if you leave all these people out there? The deprivation of citizenship, the leaving them over there, that's all easy enough. But actually, that in and of itself isn't a solution. This is a tinderbox. It will ignite again at any moment. And suddenly we're going to get sucked back in.
There's part of me that says, if she is a threat, and she does need to be punished for what she's done, then I would rather she faced British justice, in which I have confidence, the alternative being that she's in some semi-secure camp, could escape, could be released, could be liberated, and if she is still a threat, could therefore still pose a threat from another part of the world. And that's the practical debate we need to have and decide where we are safest, not where she is safest.
Tim Lawton, Conservative MP, Home Affairs Select Committee. Now, the London skyline at twilight, then a block of flats. Shamima Begum's school friend Khadija Sultana died in Raqqa. Amira Abbas is also believed to have been killed. Her best friend Sharmina, who recruited them, escaped the camp. We have discovered that she is back with ISIS.
You can say she was groomed and manipulated, so she should be able to come back. But then on the other side, you think if she does come back, would other people who have the same toxic ideas that she had think it's okay to do what she did?
Shamima bears prime responsibility for her own situation. But even if she's guilty of a terrorist act or of terrorist involvement, she is still a child of our society and she is our responsibility.
Shamima Begum's lawyers want her British citizenship returned. They say she is a victim of grooming and child trafficking and that she's been left in exile for life. The British government believes she's a threat to national security. Their lawyers say she joined a brutal terror group with her eyes open. A red double-decker bus pulls up at the side of the road.
Do you regret joining ISIS?
Of course, I will regret it for the rest of my life. Whether you can see it on my face or not, it kills me inside.
What would you say to your 15-year-old self now?
Don't do it, bitch. Just don't do it.
Really?
Yeah, that's all I would say. She wouldn't believe me anyway. She would not have listened to me.
She'd have still decided to go.
Probably, yeah. She was too arrogant at that time.